The Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 176.
Quickie.
That's right. Yeah, because we want to get in out here before the bad weather hits.
Yeah, and we're actually kind of back-to-back as far as our recording activity, but, you know, weekends, that is, just to clarify.
Yeah.
We might get a little snow, might get a little slick. It's above freezing right now, but it's going to, by noon, it's going to be below freezing, and I have to drive back to Detroit, so.
It's January, and it's 42, and a guy was riding his motorcycle in the rain on my way here, which I found interesting.
Really? Kidding. Wow.
He's going to regret that in a couple hours.
Yeah, he will. Hopefully, he was going home.
Yeah.
From the biker bar.
From the biker bar.
So, anyway, so, Tony. What did you do since the last time we talked?
I found out how washer machines work, clothes washers.
What'd you have?
And I had to fix my clothes washer.
Great.
I had to replace the motor coupler. It goes between the transmission and the...
Wow, that looks like it's cracked.
So this is the bad one. Mm-hmm. So if you're watching on the YouTube video, you can see parts come right off.
Yeah, he's got this... Yeah, you can see this rubber washer around this...
It's two different plastic pieces. One goes on the motor, one goes on the transmission, and then the rubber kind of keeps them together. And
yeah, there you go.
Causes like it gives like a little.
So you were able to fix your washer without seeking outside.
I was. YouTube is awesome.
Yes,
and because we're in Michigan or because we're in the Metro Detroit area, there is this place called RepairClinic.com.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And actually, I've been going to Amazon for the last, like, year to get stuff.
Okay.
And I compared prices, and they were decent, but then shipping from Amazon was better. So I'd always do that. Well, I looked up, you know, on the Repair Clinic website, you could say local pickup and find out, you know, and I'm like, I wonder where they're at. They're in Canton. On Michigan Avenue.
For those who aren't familiar, Canton is on the west side of the metro area, and so Tony's kind of on the southwest side of the metro area.
Yeah, so it was
convenient.
Yeah, it was on my way into work. I went over there first, picked up the part before I'd be into work, and and I had a full day or 2 days before Amazon would have got it.
Wow,
to me.
So Kim's gonna be able to spend the whole day washing. Is that the upshot?
Well, we share just those tasks.
I'm a joke, of course.
Yeah.
A joke, but, well, that's great.
Yeah.
All right, so yeah, repaired your washer. What else did you do?
Yeah, and
washed clothes. We got that settled. What else did you do?
I have another show and tell.
All right.
I attempted my first hard drive head replacement.
Yeah, and for anyone listening, Tony in his left hand has got this little hard drive head assembly. It's got a bunch of, doesn't have all the heads on there, Tony, does it?
No, yeah, well, actually, there's two of them, and it's just the mounts where the heads are supposed to stick off the end here.
Mm-hmm.
And I know on the video you guys aren't going to be able to see any of this, but and especially people listening.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to describe it.
But anyway, so this is off the bad hard drive. And so I watched one of the videos from a guy from myharddrivedie.com, and he also does a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And told me how to make a little tool for free. And unfortunately, I couldn't tell if I was successful with the hard drive or the head replacement because the platters on the affected hard drive, it was bad also. So I couldn't tell whether it actually worked or not.
Yeah. Wow.
So, yeah.
That's cool.
Well, yeah. Among other things that was crazy yesterday, it's been a busy week for me.
Yeah. Well, you look a little... harried.
Yeah. Oh,
you forgot to wear a hat.
Yeah, I forgot my hat.
It's okay. Tony, you're among friends.
All right.
Not to worry. I've got my upcoming, not this coming week, because I'm going to be out of town in South Carolina, but week after, I've got my presentation for Southeast Michigan BSD User Group. I'm going to be presenting Ghost BSD. To those guys who are kind of more into the server side of things. So I think it'll be an interesting thing. But I've been working on my presentation, my slides, and I think I've touched on this before, but I just simply have done a deeper dive into Ghost BSD and now have put some things on the slides, done a little comparison with the other desktop BSD offering, which is PC BSD, which is, you know, another solid, well, I'm not gonna say distro, but solid version. And, it's, you know, when you spend some time on one thing and you're, instead of flitting like I do across 50 different things, it's surprising what you learn.
Your audience, what, do you know what they currently use on their desktop? Are they generally Linux
OpenBSD? Yeah, no, they this is a BSD group.
I know, but you said they were familiar with servers, not so much the desktop.
Oh yeah, I think they're running FreeBSD and OpenBSD primarily. They hadn't even really heard of GhostBSD.
Ah.
See, and so somebody who like myself, who comes from the desktop side of things, is more, I think, tends to look for those types of.
Alternatives.
Operating systems, I think. And then because these guys are more server guys, they'll say, well, I run this on my server, but you know, I think I could probably get this to run on my desktop. So that's sort of, I think that's the angle that they take. And then Tom's going to be presenting, PF Sense there in April. So cool. I'm looking forward to that. So, but anyway, that's what I've been kind of focusing on. And, that's about it.
All right,
Tom. You notice, Tom, we've got you last.
Got me last.
Because you always do such interesting things. Mine just look pale by comparison.
Well, I'm doing the talk. I'm actually doing a few different talks. You know, I mentioned Mensa last time. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to pick what tech tracks I'm going to do at PenguinCon. But I'm going to get into with the why open source matters for the Mensa, which actually I'm going to bring here to the show as part of our fresh look, some of the things I'm researching, and so we can have a discussion on it. Because I think there's some neat things going on.
Yeah.
And bringing them to light would be pretty awesome. Other than that, not overly intense week. I had more school with my Goldman Sachs program, which we had an interesting class on HR. And they bring in instructors who sometimes are professors, but also people who have worked in the industry. And HR sounds boring. This was so far one of the best modules of the class. The guy was engaging, entertaining, and he would start by saying, Babson College put the program together, and he would start by saying, I'm channeling Babson College, and let me read these. He goes, all right, now I'm off the book, and let's talk about things.
He always
would start things like, we learn with stories. And it's so much fun, and all the different little things he told us. But he really talked about, we talked about Zappos, and if you're not familiar with Zappos, they're a company that has an insane culture, and they're actually a very popular Vegas tourist spot.
They have
people who do full-time tours of the Zappos facility, but a lot of the HR talk wasn't centered around legalities. It was centered around how you build company culture, how you create an environment people want to work in, and things like that. So we talked a lot about examples of companies that have a lot of fun inside of them, and Zappos is definitely on the crazy edge of that. There's a book on it called Delivering Happiness by there. Because Zappos, one of the crazy things he did was, they said, we have
a
great place.
Is there a delivery charge?
Yeah. They said, we're going to pay anyone who doesn't want to work here $2,000 to leave. So they went through the entire company.
Wow.
Offered $2,000. Only a couple people took advantage of it. And they said, well, we found this is a problem. We upped it to $4,000 and no one else left. Uh-huh. And they said, okay, we figured, you know, it's not a money thing. So they talk a lot about how they built a culture like that, which is kind of cool. And it's important to have a good work environment that you want to go to, that you are excited to go for your job.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of talk, which has made it really interesting, because it's not like, if you just say, we're going to do a class on HR, you're like, no. That doesn't sound like anything I want to sit through.
Yeah.
Right.
But when you make it fun and interactive like that.
Did they talk about Beer Fridays?
No, well, we talked about Mimosa Mondays. And because one of the other guys, he has a programming company and the web development company, and they have Mimosa Mondays.
Nice.
They also have a party button in their office that he hits that controls all the hue lighting and turns the radio up real loud. That's how whenever they celebrate, because they're project-based, so whenever they finish a large project and it gets delivered and activated at the client, they hit the party button and break out the whiskey.
All right.
You know, I was in a project-based job, but whenever I finish my projects, we always took out the crying towels.
Yeah, so it's kind of, that was kind of fun and interesting, though. It was a good time.
That sounds fun.
Yes, yes. So, he also does, if you look up HR horror stories, the guy's a writer.
HR horror stories.
And he's
got
some great horror stories. The one I shared with him, I'll do it real quick here. So, around 2007 when the job market crashed, this is my friend worked for a company. And this was the craziest HR story. So they're dealing with the HR person, like, what are you going to do? Like, the job market crashed, and of course, when you put a job out there, there's 300 resumes came in 1 week. And they're like, how are you going to deal with them all? And the HR guy said, he goes, I don't work with unlucky people. And they go, okay. He goes, that's how I'm going to sort these. I'm going to get rid of all the unlucky people. He goes, well, how do you know if they're unlucky? And he grabbed half the stack and he put it in the garbage. He goes, they're unlucky. I can't work with them. Oh, gee. He goes, there. Now I only have 100 resumes to sort.
Huh.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny. He's asked, so he says, is that legal? He goes, well, he didn't discriminate by any measure. He goes, I don't know. He goes, you can do random sort, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, there's some other gross level sorts you could do, too. I mean, you take a look at a cover letter. You take a look, depending on how they were submitted. Kind of I mean, because I managed a scanning center for a while. And we were hiring people, and it's amazing when people apply for jobs.
They'll put anything in a resume.
You can tell who spent some time putting together a cover letter and who didn't.
Yes.
Man,
I get a lot of job applications. My job, and I some other companies do this too, is literally testing. And that's how a lot of the companies have gone to.
Sure.
When my friend took his programming job, they sat him down and said, code for the solution. He's like, I'm here for an interview. And they go, yep. That's your interview. Code for a solution. If you can't code for the solution, you don't get to do the interview.
Mm.
So he walked in at 8 a.m. and they gave him till 11 to finish it. I mean, it's not like one little line of code. Like, they literally, you sit down for a few hours and code, and if you can't accomplish the task, if you can't take these data sets and produce the result, and they don't let you use Google, they don't let you go on GitHub and pull some code, you sit down at the computer and you write for the solution. And some people couldn't do it.
Yeah, well.
Because he had 11 people in there, and I think two of them left without finishing. They just couldn't hack it. And he's like, are we competing? He says, no, we have 22 positions open. And he goes, oh, because he thought he was competing against him. Like, no, we can hire every one of you if you can code.
Wow.
So I'm like, that's intense.
That's intense.
That's neat. And once you can do it, then you can go.
In a good way, then
you can have an interview.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great way to, and I kind of do it a little bit similar. So everyone can put things in resumes, but I actually sit down with people and say, can you fix this? Tell me how you fixed it is part of how I start. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I've even had sample computers set up that are store stock ones. Load Windows on this, do this, or remove a virus from this, or do something so I can see them work. Uh-huh. Yes. And that makes a big difference.
I just unplug it in the back just to see if they're...
Check the obvious things.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, but speaking of HR, I'll be quick about it, but it's not directly related to what you just said. There was this woman who was working at this restaurant. Okay, she'd been there a month. And her manager groped her, and so she went to HR to try to find out how to deal with that, to make that stop, because she didn't want that to continue. She didn't want to get the guy in trouble. Well, anyway, it started this ball rolling, and he had been there like 12 years, so they ended up firing her because they basically sat her down and said, he's been here for 12 years, you've been here for 2 months. Mm. And basically she said, well, I'm not going to quit. You're going to have to fire me. And so they interviewed a lawyer, and he said, if you want a video for how not to handle an employee harassment situation, that would be the first example.
Wow.
So anyway, yeah, I was shocked that they did that. So anyway, but anyway, I'm back to Linux.
Back to Linux.
I viewed it on a Linux computer, so that's the relation.
There you go.
So, well, that was kind of interesting, though, Tom.
It was fun.
You're thinking about how, but that's a good way to differentiate, because you can throw, I can say, hey, wow, I took Python, blah, blah, blah. But if you try to sit me down now and have me code my way out of a box, I would be hard pressed to do it.
Really, if that's what your job is to do, it makes sense. And that's a great way to filter them out, because everyone's going to put, oh, yeah, I know C and Python and PHP, but do you know it? And I can say I know it because I modify our own systems enough to get by, but I'm not. If you ask me to code from scratch, I already know I couldn't do it. But there's people who, they want a job, they're trying to break into the market, so they'll do that.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. So, all right. So I think we're going to get back on to what's next? I guess listener feedback?
Listener feedback.
Drones.
Right. Yeah, so Tom, you got got some feedback on your drone comment.
I did. And he's got a good point. So, what was the listener's name? Sorry. So we got a couple of them.
Yeah.
I don't want to get his name wrong.
Because I think it all stemmed, while you look for that, I'll just briefly say that to fill the dead space, that it all stemmed from our conversation, I think, on the last couple episodes ago when we talked about, we were talking about some of these drones and
And the FCC
security
registration
and all of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, and there is a concern, and this is, and correct me if I'm wrong, and this is, Frank said yes, the people should register them because there are a lot of people that do dumb things and they don't realize they're dumb things, so this would help accountability. My argument is one, if someone's going to do something illegal, so he's got a good point, yes, people probably, you know, people are going to do something incidental that it's stupid, but my point was because it's an open registration system and kind of a voluntary one, and this is my solution. I'm going to tweet out maybe later today that everyone, because you can register in someone else's name, everyone register drone to the president of the FCC. I don't know his name right now, but let's everyone register it. That way every drone is registered to him.
Because, right.
I mean, if you think about it from an open standpoint, if someone wants to do something bad and they want to go get someone in trouble, I register it in Tony's name. I drop the drone in the airport. Tony's got a lot of questions to answer.
I believe it starts with C.
Yeah.
Mr. FCC,
yeah.
Last name? No.
Mr. is the first, FCC is last.
Francis.
Yeah, there you go.
Right.
So there's a good point on both sides of the argument here.
Right.
And it may be all rendered moot because the FCC, for all the hobbyists, is being sued right now, because the other side of that coin is you have a lot of general public people and a genuine privacy concern because the database is public. And not everyone wants to have their name and home address and phone number and the fact that they own an expensive DJ Phantom $3,000 drone registered on a public database.
Well, they probably have a gun in their house, so they'll just shoot the intruder.
There we go.
There, see, we solved that little problem.
We solved a problem. So, the gun on the drone.
Somebody did that. I think we may have talked about
that's
that.
That's actually what made the FCC get upset.
Yes, they had then they put a flamethrower on a drone.
I love the flamethrower one. It's great.
I mean, it's,
But the reality is the guy putting the gun and a flamethrower on a drone isn't registering with the FCC.
Right.
Yeah.
And I have some more drone news later when we get to the news part, too.
All right.
Some open source drones.
So, yeah, so there was that piece of listener feedback, and then...
It was a good conversation. Frank's right. I don't disagree with him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we had, I think, one from...
we had one from S.
Yes.
Or that's Sam, where he talks a little bit more about the differences between the OpenSUSE versions that we were talking about, and that was more geared toward you, Mary, right? Or
yeah, I'm sure that it was.
Yep. So
as soon as I log into my mail, I'll pull that out. But I was so impressed with the job you were doing, Tony. I was thinking, man, I hope he keeps going.
All right, I'll get it. He says Tumbleweed is the rolling release distro that offers more modern packages. And usually releases medium to large size update packs a few times per week, where the Leap is a slower paced, highly stable release that implements core components from the Sluss. Commercial Sluss.
Yeah, when I did that review, I had mentioned that, and that's kind of how it came together.
Yeah, yeah. And then he goes on to say, as for Mensa organization,
yes,
he believes that I must comment on that it is one of the most ironic names that I've heard in a long time. He says, especially given that the high IQ society description, the word Mensa just happens to be a common slang word in Mexican Spanish for a dumb woman. So...
Quit looking at me.
No. So Tom replied.
Yeah.
The
adult in the room replied. No, just kidding. I actually thought, well, maybe it's just their little inside joke as kind of a little ha-ha.
Right.
And people will just think it means something else.
Right.
But
that is kind of ironic.
But Tom, of course, went to the website to check it out.
Yes, and I put the proper one in there.
Yes, it's... What table, I think?
Latin for round table.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Latin for round table. Is there a round table? I'm not going to pick on Mensa because that could turn into a total flame war, but I will admit, we're a round table organization. It does no discrimination, but very open. Oh, except for you can only sit at this table if your IQ is within the top 2% of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I always thought that's kind of funny. I mean, it is, you got to have something to common bring people together, but I thought that was kind of funny. But it made me think, when he said that about Mensa, it made me think of the Chevy Nova.
And,
yes.
Yeah.
Nova meaning no go.
No go.
Right. It wasn't a good seller in down south.
Right. A derivative of the verb to go, which is ir.
Yes.
IR. So anyway, that was an opportunity for me to use my college Spanish.
Yay.
All right.
But anyway, so yeah, that was kind of funny. Gabby got a kick out of that.
Yeah, it was interesting.
I think George from Tulsa posted something on our Google Plus.
Yeah, he let me get over to that.
Yeah, I was over there just a little bit ago. I'm trying to. I think I saw. Yeah,
he commented on the credit card. The credit card terminal talk that we were doing. I did my paper on.
Oh, yes.
And then, so he says, what about magnetic strip or the data on the magnetic strips, and with skimmers? And so, and how people can just take a picture mm-hmm. of the actual card, and then banks don't even verify, things like that. But,
no, and, just along those lines, I don't know if you saw that, little video that went viral of that, drive-through Starbucks where, the customer, she came back there to confront the barista in the window about her credit card suddenly having a charge for $200. Apparently, she doesn't use that card much, but the previous day, and she accused the barista, who essentially admitted it, that she took a picture of her credit card. I don't think it was a chip card, because she had to go away when the previous day she took her card, and then just said, she had to get some receipt tape. So apparently, the tape for the machine.
Right.
So she took the card, disappeared for a moment, came back with the tape and the card. But the allegation is that she took a picture of the front and back of the card while she was getting the tape.
Yeah.
And then there was this charge, and then she basically admitted it, and the employee was fired.
Yeah.
So
that's fraud.
It definitely is. But that's how chip will.
Well, yes and no. How do you use it online if you don't have the chip reader on your computer?
Well, you don't.
So how do you buy things online with credit cards? You can't anymore?
Well, my thing is, I don't know, maybe it's the fingerprint hash thing,
Chip and PIN is probably still the ideal way to do it. That's what they're doing in Europe. Mm-hmm. Ours is very broken here.
Canada. Canada, because when I went...
Actually, everywhere but here. How's that?
Yeah. Well, it's like the metric system.
We're moving to like a token-based system where, you have to... Or two-factor authentication. That's what I've seen with some banks in the past. You know, where they'll email you the, a few minutes after you go to buy it, and they'll say, hey, do you actually want to release these funds? That makes sense.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Because if you know ahead of time that's how you set it up with your bank, then you'll be sure that you've got that email open so that you can acknowledge it right away and have that purchase go through.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't go through until you acknowledge it.
Yep.
Yeah, good idea.
Something funny, if you guys want to look it up, there's a Twitter account called Need a Debit Card, and it's been around for a while. Anytime anyone posts a picture of a credit card, they retweet it.
Oh, jeez.
And people do it by accident. It's sitting on the table in a selfie they did. It's anywhere that there's a credit card number, it retweets credit card numbers. I think it's some of an automated account.
Wow.
I'm surprised. Unless they don't do the whole number, though, do they?
They do. I'm
surprised that Twitter hasn't shut that down.
Because they're retweeting. So they actually need to shut down the person who tweeted it. They're retweeting everybody's credit card number who posted online on accident.
Of course, it's only the front. They don't have the back where you need the three character codes.
There's a few that have front and back.
It does. This person even tweeted their social security card.
Oh, my God.
It's a fun Twitter account. It's been around for a long time.
Yeah.
That's shocking to me.
There's a lot of issues with credit card. We need to go to a better system. Chip and PIN is definitely a way to do it, because now you have something and something you have. And that's mm-hmm. when it comes to security, that's what you need. Something and something you have, and you put those two things together to complete the transaction.
Yep, that makes
sense.
And
when you do token-based, when you create a hash from those two pieces of information,
mm-hmm.
now it's token-based, and you eliminate the replay attack, which the replay attack is when you get with the skimmer, they get your credit card number, and that's what the chips in there are supposed to do, is eliminate the replay attacks. Because mm-hmm. what the skimmer does is, gets the card and you can reuse it over and over again. So that's the replay attacks. When you use a single, American Express came out with this, and this goes back almost 15 years ago. I had one only because they did this. Used to, when you wanted to buy things online, you would log into your American Express account. They would generate a random credit card number for you. It was a token system that could only be used once. You would tell them the amount. So I needed to buy something for $42. You would type in the $42. You'd open up their website mm-hmm. and you'd See, I wanted a credit card for 42. It would generate a number that you could then paste into whatever website as a transaction, and it was a randomly generated American Express number. Mm-hmm. And then you would put it in, and the amounts had to match, and everything had to match. So I had to be logged into two websites at once to make this work, but it was a great system at the time. I think it didn't scale because, well, generating random credit card numbers to make it compatible, obviously the number of people using credit cards online and number of credit cards available scaled up, and there's not enough numbers, but the concept is still there. I like that concept to have to go to your financial institution, have them generate a transaction ID and an amount, and it matches. There's no replay attack. The card number can only be used once. So even
I
if
think
anything...
Isn't that how most electronic pay stuff is now? Where
behind the scenes.
The behind the scenes of yes. the Apple and
Apple Pay and Google Pay. Are both of them are token-based. So there's no replay attack. They're mm-hmm. token transaction. But it's... There's still some security flaws in it.
Well, yeah, and then not to mention the fact that you got to go through the steps. But I think the point, one of the points in the discussion that was posted was the fact that, you know, you think about the little retailers that are going to have to make an investment to get that extra yes. technology. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know about you guys, your yeah. shop. If you've already done it or are going to do it? Or
You know, I don't know because they haven't set me anything on it and I haven't called okay. the credit card company. I mm-hmm. mean, but I imagine I'm going to have to go spend a few $100 and get another machine. Because yeah. I don't have the machine that's got it, but it's they haven't told me to get it, so I don't just run out and spend the money.
Yeah. Yeah, but and I think some of the companies are providing some little rebates. You know, in other yeah. words, you're going to get a little bit off or discount or something like that.
I actually got my machine for free. It's the volume of business we do entitled us to a free machine. So,
oh, okay. That's good.
Well, they get a couple percent, so it's not well,
they make it up
really
on the,
free.
Yeah, they, right. make, yeah, they make it up on the volume of charges.
And actually, that's actually how they work. Mm-hmm. They look at the volume of charges that we do and go, well, we really want you to do that volume with our company, so right. well, we would like to give you a box to do this with.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... And that was, that was another listener feedback.
Yeah, that was George from Delta. And then he went on to talk about micropayments. Mm-hmm. The email I have kind of cut off the.
Oh, well, let me.
His whole comment. Oh, here we go.
Yeah, you know, and Tom, this was addressed mainly to you, just about micropayments. Mm. And the fact that these days I think it's being highly promoted, but tying your YouTube, I think it was at YouTube Red.
Yeah.
To Google that you've basically kind of gone into the Google sphere and have
yes.
surrendered any anonymity or anything.
I have,
which,
right.
You know, I think the key thing there is if you know that you've done that and you are quote unquote okay with it, then that's mm-hmm. you know your situation. But that was his point as far as you know that arrangement. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he says even if you didn't want to use a credit card, you know, that ties your credit card to your Google account, and even if you didn't want to use it, that you can't use things like, it's a wallet balances or gift cards for subscriptions. Google won't allow you to use those.
Right. We had in my office yesterday, we had an off-the-grid discussion, and... So that becomes mm-hmm. interesting. We talk about ways to live off the grid. It's a roundtable discussion I've had, and I've actually mm-hmm. thought about talking about it a little bit at maybe one of my Penguin panels, because very few people know this. I have a weird off-the-grid life I have. I actually turn my paychecks into cash, and I don't even have a personal credit card, personal debit card, or anything. I put enough money to make to pay my bills, and then everything else I do cash transactions for private mm-hmm. personal. My business, 100% on the books. My business is what pays for all my Google identity. So everything with Google is actually completely tied to my business.
There you go.
My personal life, you couldn't even tell what grocery store I shopped at. I don't even have a credit card, so you can track it.
But you know that's going to be changing over time.
Yes, there comes a time, and that's what makes me wonder how that's going to change, because I just choose not to do it. It all started from my mm-hmm. days of being a 2600 subscriber, and I participated in a fun game 2600 had. Was all of us got the same credit card. I think there was up to 3,000 of us with the same Kroger card.
Oh yeah.
So our shopping habits were the shopping habits of 3,000 hackers.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of Mountain Dew on that. But we all shared the same number for a long time to see how we don't really know what happens. But
who paid the bill?
Well, this is
not a credit card.
The Kroger card where they do your shopping habit tracking.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, we all
rewards card.
One guy, I don't remember who started this idea, but it just kind of kept getting more and more people. We'd write in and we'd put their code card number, and then you would use, because you can pipe in the PIN without the card, and we would all use the same one.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was a fun game for a while.
They used to do a similar thing at Washlug where it's all the tinfoil hat guys over there. They have like five or six of those, the actual physical cards, and they would just rotate up through the six of them. And
yeah.
So again, it like screws up their analytics. And
that was the whole goal, is to mess up Kroger's analytics for trying to track our shopping habits. Now they have the, well, then again, they technically have the aggregated shopping habits of 3,000, 2,600 readers, which probably means Mountain Dew and at the time Jolt. Lots of Jolt cola.
Yeah.
We're getting soft drink ads. All right. Well, anyway, we probably ought to move on.
All right.
Any other listener feedback? Because that's where we still are.
Oh, yeah. What were we talking about? Living off the grid?
Yeah. Right. Well, that might be a good fresh look, you know, as far as...
It's interesting to think about how you can be anonymous. And it's hard to be anonymous. TCP/IP was not designed to be anonymous.
No.
Exactly, yeah. And security in general has been had to be bolted onto TCP/IP.
Yeah.
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 Well, it started as a college exchange of information. So they go, we didn't know you guys were going to use it for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. All right. Well, I guess...
All right. Yeah, we're going on to the hot distros this week.
Yeah.
Distro fever.
Distro fever.
Well...
Can you sing a distro or a disco song?
Distro fever.
I cannot.
No, okay. We're going to lose the three listeners we have. So we better stop that. But I'll tell you, since we really just have a few days and that we just came out of the holiday, the list was pretty darn short. But one that really caught my eye was Parted Magic, because they just had a release this week, and this particular distro, they've got a payment model. So if you want to download Parted Magic, you've got to pony up $9. Or they also have a I'll call it a business model. I mean, it's really it's pay for play business model, but. Mm-hmm. The other option that they've got is a one-year subscription that you can purchase for $49, and that'll entitle you to updates and that type of thing for 12 months. So if you're a commercial entity and you want to make use of it, because I contemplated just paying them $9 just simply because anybody who does that amount of work, I've advocated for, sending a donation their way. Now, I didn't do it for Parted Magic, but certainly...
Actually, I do. I use Parted Magic a lot with the stuff I do with setting up computers, and I really like it. So I do. I've bought theirs two or three times already.
Yeah. I think it's a good good deal.
Donated.
One of the tools that they've got too, and Tom, this is, this will kind of circle back to our discussion from an episode or two ago, about erasing hard drives and the setup that you've got. These guys, have you ever used their Secure Erase?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. I was kind of going through here looking at it.
It works well, and it's based on the same concepts.
I tried to find, when you're talking about the DoD standard.
Yeah.
I was trying to go through here to see if there was a mention of what standard they adhere to. It wasn't clearly obvious to me which one they use, but in looking at some of the screenshots they had set up, they said that this one here to erase this one Western Digital drive was going to take 44 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking to myself, it's probably pretty close to that DoD.
Yeah.
That's a 250 gig drive that they're showing in that screenshot.
Yeah. And what you're looking at is it's basically three passes of random data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's the generally, without getting all the technical details, it's generally three end-to-end random passes of data.
Yeah, because technically, when you go to do like a quick format on a hard drive,
it just erases the partition table.
Yeah, it just erases the partition table, and all the data is still there. It's just the hard drive isn't looking for anything there, so overwrites when you're saving new things.
Mm-hmm.
When you do a full format, all it does is it goes over it once, and the whole drive once, and it...
But if it's using a specific algorithm, you can kind of backwards engineer it to...
Right, because of magnetic flux, and I can't remember all the technical terms.
So this is how it works. If you went over the drive and you wrote everything is zero, so it's kind of like if you erase something that's written on a whiteboard and you erase it once but don't write anything over the top of it, you can possibly see latent images behind it.
Sure.
So if there was latent,
and if you don't use that nice liquid cleaner,
yeah, you don't use liquid cleaner.
Yeah, that'll definitely.
Yeah. So the, and it's the concept of instead of just erasing the whiteboard, they actually rewrite over it three different times with some randomness. Mm-hmm. So that becomes all of a sudden I can't distinguish the noise from what was previously there.
Sure.
But format, it just resets everything to all ones or all zeros in one swipe. So it does erase it. And it's all theoretical. It's not like it's there's an easy program. Oh yeah, if you format it, no problem. Just run this utility, and it pulls off all the latent information. It's really technical and very difficult to recover. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it can be done is why.
Right.
But this brings us to SSDs that can't be wiped. So that's an interesting problem.
Oh, I was not even aware of that.
So then this is why you can't wipe an SSD perfectly. So if you have a 128 gig SSD, there's a certain amount of overhead because as cells go bad for wear leveling purposes, it automatically pulls out and removes pieces of the SSD. And it does this behind the scenes automatically through the system.
No, wait a minute. Let me back you up a little bit. When you say pieces of the SSD, you're talking... When you say electronic bits.
Yeah, it's not physically.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought.
It doesn't physically move it. It just reallocates.
Reallocates.
Okay, gotcha.
So we can take a piece and say, you know what, this cell has not passed the test. So it then can take that piece of information and it says that cell's bad. We're going to grab from the pool of good cells. Now, whatever little piece of data is in that cell, because it's now marked it as do not use, what if someone retakes that drive after you've erased it and done the random three-pass wipe? There's still bits. If someone figured out how to reactivate the bits that were then turned off, there's still data that was held within there.
Oh, I see.
Then that kind of comes to the point of you can't truly ever erase them.
Well, you could if you turned them back on and then did something at that point.
Thing,
but I mean, we're talking just from a normal course of activity.
Yes, like these utilities
that
they have.
It's going to sit out there.
So kind of interesting.
Huh.
So.
Yeah, it is. But just getting back to Parted Magic and why it kind of caught my eye as far as distros go. You know, one thing that they do for boot up is they don't use Grub for boot up. They use SysLinux. Now, I went and looked it up, and SysLinux is kind of an interesting, it looks like an interesting project. I've not really used it at all. I've just tended to gravitate toward either Grub or just the FreeBSD bootloader when I'm using FreeBSD.
Right, and the difference is SysLinux is really designed for, or was designed for CDs, optical drives.
Yeah.
Okay.
And where Grub was designed for physical hard drives or now flash drives.
Uh-huh.
And it's been designed now that you can use it on flash drives and hard drives if you really want to. It's just not as flexible as what Grub is, as far as I understand it.
I gotcha. Yep, that certainly makes sense because you tend to run this thing off of a CD.
Yeah, now, exactly.
The other thing, too, that Parted Magic includes, if you really want to take a look at what each, and they've got a whole nice version list.
Package list, yeah.
They've got a whole list of everything that is on the... on the release, and we're talking, I'm still scrolling. So what's nice about this is it's going to allow you to scan this list, and if you're looking for something specific, they've got a little search feature there that you can then just type in a few characters, and it'll go right to a particular, you know, for example, if you want to see if Nmap is on here, or if you want to see Safe Copy, you know, it's all here. I suspect that there's probably nothing missing. Yeah.
Right, yeah, especially for either system testing or drive maintenance or and data recovery tools that are on here.
Yeah, so
it's a very nice setup.
Yeah, so if you're looking to recover something or do any kind of maintenance, that type of thing, this is a great tool to use.
Yeah.
So Parted Magic caught my eye. Oh, you know, one thing too they mentioned, I thought it was kind of unusual. Apparently, in this particular release, they have in their news area, they've got something called the LX panel, which, you know, they use LXDE for their desktop manager. They said, got us again. And apparently, if the path equals variable on that file is blank, it won't launch the program. And the UNET bootin and Tiger VNC desktop files both have that path equals blank. They'll not launch. So these desktop files are years old, and this bug happened when we updated the LX panel for this release. So they said if you're using those options, they basically tell you, they give you how to fix
pass
that.
The variables along so it doesn't equal blank. That makes sense.
So So anyway, yeah, so that kind of caught my eye as a little negative, but that's the only negative. Otherwise, it looks, you know, pretty solid. What a great tool. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was caught my eye. What about you? On the distros, anything caught
No, that was
eye?
It. Yeah, I looked through the same thing. I mean, as for the two other things that were released this week was Ubuntu as a development, Mate development. So 16.04 is coming up here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that too.
And then there was a release for Linux Mint, KDE, and XFCE. I don't use either of those desktops, but I use Cinnamon. So this it's not included in this release that they're talking about because Cinnamon was already released with 17.3. So it wasn't like a big hot thing for me, but if you're using KDE or XFCE, go ahead and update your Mint and you'll be all set.
Yeah. You'll be happy.
Yeah.
All right. So that's Distro Fever for this episode. I guess we'll...
Going on to some news.
Yeah.
And Soundboard.
N-E.
Tech news and views.
I need to reorganize them all into the right order. Sorry, guys.
Tony's finger was just like spinning around.
Which one is it? Which one is it? I don't see it.
Oh, that's what happens early in the morning sometimes.
That's right.
We're not fully awake. So, hey, news. Well, I'll tell you, we never saw this coming. We never saw this coming department. There's this headline. Fedora 24 will likely be delayed.
Quit picking on them.
I'm doing it good naturedly because, you know, as I said before, Fedora is a pretty good distro. I just couldn't help it. It just makes me laugh. And that was actually, something that, came out in, Phoronix, I think, a few days ago.
But you know, so. I agree with them. Delaying because
I do too.
I would rather have the model of it come out a little bit late and be stable than have the Ubuntu model where you don't install it for the first month because you know there's going to be problems.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree, but I think I would take it back a little further to how is your release schedule configured and all the various steps you have to that release point. Do you need to include maybe an extra release candidate space or something like that? Because otherwise then these headlines come out and then it's up to us podcasters, people like myself, to mock it and have some fun with it.
Right.
In a good natured way. I mean, it's just sort of.
So funny. You think
just,
their internal date should have been like a month ago and then their public date should have been today and then there would have been no.
Delay. The question, you know, I think it's GCC, they're saying won't be officially released until March or later. The plan has been to get the current GCC6 compiler snapshot into the Fedora 24 repository by the end of January. So, you know, it's kind of a balancing act because you're dependent on this other project getting its stuff out. And if there's a delay there, then that's going to impact you. So, you know, it's, and that's, I think, the difference between Linux and BSD, because BSD doesn't really have that problem. Yeah. And I'm not saying that and saying, hey, it's better, because, you know, each operating system has its strengths and weaknesses. I'm just saying that they release as a complete operating system. It's not, you know, Linux is the kernel, and then you've got all these other projects, and you're going to take kind of a snapshot release of where the thing is, but if you want to get that latest and greatest, because that's kind of how Fedora is. They want the latest and the greatest, typically. You know, just kind of cutting edge. Ooh, I cut myself there. You know, bleeding edge. Is it cutting edge or bleeding edge?
Bleeding edge.
Okay, bleeding edge. There you go. But anyway, so that's I think what happens, and then that's why the headline happens, and that's why I end up noting it.
And I imagine it goes to anything with a lot of the open source projects there's so much interdependencies on different things. Because there was a good discussion on, hey, when's Ubuntu getting the new hot kernel so you can do the hot patching on it?
Updating, yeah.
And of course, there's not a clear answer on it, you know, because there's a lot of dependencies on it. Maybe it'll be in the 16.10 is what people are hoping, but they don't know for sure. You know, there's not a clear, but I think it's not because they don't want to answer. I mean, they want it in as soon as possible. If there's all the dependencies that they have to be built upon it to put it in the system. So,
yeah, I mean, I would just say it's not going to be in Ubuntu, until it's officially released, from that, you know, from the kernel project. And then when it's released, it's going to be, you know, you're going to take a few weeks or however long you need to take just to make sure that any little bugs or things that may have gotten through are fixed before it even comes out on Ubuntu, because it seems to me you'd want to have that to be fairly solid, because there are a lot of not only Ubuntu users, but projects that use Ubuntu as their underpinning, you know, yes. their release. So
We're very interconnected. It is a house of cards. I mean, Linux is very interconnected.
So, yeah. I mean, and it's, you know, it's a something to pay attention to. So anyway, so that was just something. I mean, I only said it because there was the what I perceived to be a slight comedic value to it. The other thing that I noted, and Tony, this may be something that actually I'm sorry that I didn't have this webpage already up, but there's a prominent Chinese cracking group. They claim that game piracy could be dead within 2 years because of the digital rights, just advances in the digital rights movement. And according to them, they're saying it's getting harder and more difficult to crack these games and these other things. So,
well, and what's leading to that is one, good encryption, better implementation of it. Mm-hmm. But the other side of the coin is so many of these games are online play, online activated. So it's really hard to run a cracked version of a game when there's an authentication model of you have to connect the game to the bigger part of the game. So
That's
you can't play it without being online.
That's a good
kind of
point.
Thing.
Too, yeah.
Well, and because each game is serial numbered, you have to have your serial number registered in order to play the game. But that's also why some of these games, more and more of them, are moving to the game is free, so to speak. It's all mm-hmm. subscription service.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's not a way to crack the subscription service.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, I thought that was just kind of interesting, from the advances in encryption and then just the shift in the model itself.
Yeah. But while the Chinese are giving up, they've made even more headway. Every week, there's another new story about how much further they're going along with PlayStation hacking, with PlayStation 4. So they might be thrown in the towel, but not everybody is.
Yeah, Sony. I tell you, that's Sony.
That's Sony.
Jeez. And let's see, do they have anything else? I was also just going to mention before I shift, I hope that came through as shift.
Yeah.
Before I shifted over to you guys is that, the Free Software Foundation, they want to get your feedback. And so they have, they want your vision for the Free Software Foundation. So depending on who you are, there could be a variety of visions for the future of this organization. But anyway, they're looking for feedback. And so there's a link to a survey, and they said it only takes 5 to 15 minutes to complete, and it will be up until the end of January. So that's for the next 3 weeks or so. So they're looking for results. I'm kind of curious, you know, actually to be candid, I did not click the survey itself. I just saw this article earlier, and I wanted to see what survey implement they used. Well, this looks like somebody probably just maybe coded it from scratch, I guess. You know, I spun up Lime Survey. I may have talked about this on the last episode, and I tell you, I just love that that project. Yeah. But anyway, so if you want to provide some input to the Free Software Foundation, they are looking for your input. So, and aside from a KDE Corner, which we'll get to after the news, that's all I got.
All right. The only thing I had for like regular news stuff is Linux Mint 18 will be codenamed Sarah. And they said they like the name Sarah because it's
Sarah Smile.
Sarah is a Jewish feminine name given in many different areas of the world. Mm-hmm. So it's very, a common throughout the world. So I think that's nice. I like the name Sarah too.
And that's Sarah with an H at the end.
Yes.
Versus just S-A-R-A.
So correct.
Just that small distinction.
All right. So Tom, what'd you find?
Well,
Tom, I bet you don't have anything today, do you?
Nothing at all. All right, here's some good news in the open source world. Everyone knows I'm a big pfSense fan, but I also do like the consumer products like the DDWRT open source router projects. Linksys revealed at CES that all their WRT routers will have DDWRT support, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So you're going to be able to load this. Now, ASUS has actually been a leader in this of some of the open source mm-hmm. stuff, because ASUS says we're a hardware company and we're going to allow it, and I think Linksys, who used to say, don't hack our routers, is going, well, those ASUS people seem to be pretty successful. So I think there's some influence in the market from them, which, but that's great. You know, then we can have routers that we can play with, we can hack, or just in general make more secure through open source. Automotive Linux. I'm wearing my Made in Detroit shirt today, and it's because of this great article I read on Automotive Linux. We got buy-in from, unfortunately, General Motors isn't in there, but Ford is leading the pack on this. Automotive Linux is not for the systems of the car, but more for all the interface systems, the dash systems and things like that. And it's basically to develop some open source standards, and ways that you can interface with the car, and it'll create more interoperability. Cause obviously we want our phone to be integrated into the car. So we're looking back at the dash and not at our device. That's kind of the goals. It's also to have some good security on there. And I imagine the bug reports could be fun in Automotive Linux because it could kill you. So they're, when they say serious kernel problem, they mean a really serious kernel problem. But, it's still cool.
Although, is that, are they making the distinction where it's going to be separated, the operation of the car is going to be separated from the entertainment system?
Well, I hope they are, because as we've learned, that's not, we've had the car hacks before, and it was always because there wasn't that. And this is to set some ground rules of the radio buttons don't control the brakes. I'm sure there's some of that kind of talk in there. But raising that bar of awareness, because unfortunately, the reason the Chrysler hacks and some of those did, you have people that worked in a bubble. They didn't think about the world the same way that technology people and security people think about the world. So they ended up just going, well, it's more convenient if we just tie all these systems together, because then I can use one wire and one data bus
and
for
that'll
everything.
Save. That'll save a dollar.
Yeah, it'll save a dollar. So that creates kind of a problem. Automotive Linux is a consortium. It's going to be meeting in 2016. Like I said, we've got all the big names in there. Not just automotive names. You have a lot of other people like Panasonic and Pioneer and some of the other consumer companies, because they also want to build products that go into these cars that are based on this. And a common platform means that you can more interoperability between them. So that's really nice. There is a new startup that does some cool drones that got released at CES. It's drones that run on Linux and stream 30 frame a second video. They even have some Android features that use Google Cardboard, so you can stick the cardboard on your head and control the drone and have a first person view of the camera on the drone.
They're
under $200. Pretty neat product. It is actually, I should probably list the name here. What's the name of the company?
It's
Power Up FPV. The name of the company is Power Up Toys. You can Google them and find their company information. LibreOffice. We kind of missed this last time, but this is kind of an important milestone. LibreOffice is making it to the cloud. It's an integration project with OwnCloud, OpenSUSE, and a few other companies. But it's the first beta releases here, maybe even alpha, but it's integration to compete with Google Docs. I admit, I really like Google Docs, been using it for years. It just works. It's so smooth. The collaboration, it's great for when I'd use it with my employees when we're collaborating on web development projects. It's just really nice to have real time, easy way to access from my phone or from any computer, all the documents and with a shared work environment, with lots of bells and whistles. Well, they're finally coming around, and I'm certainly going to be start playing with this because I'm a huge OwnCloud fan for all of my document synchronization. So definitely pretty cool there.
It's very cool. Yeah, I saw the same release a little bit ago, and I tried looking into how to set it up on my own OwnCloud, and it wasn't easily found.
No, available. Not yet. And a little bit of work. Yeah. But I think the last thing, and we haven't seen anything widespread on this other than but it shows where we're going in the market with this, is Ransom 32, the first ransomware written JavaScript. Now, the payload can be, because it's delivered through JavaScript, it can be delivered cross-platform. So far, no one's been able to, I think you'd brought up, Mary, exploit it under Linux very effectively. But ransomware as a service basically is the problem here. And you have people who are offering the ransomware, and then they buy the service from the guys offering the ransomware, and then the individuals create the payload delivery methods to which to encrypt, and everyone gets a cut of the money. And we're going to see more and more of this business model, nefarious business model at that.
Now, here's a question. I'm not sure if this is the right question to ask, but as far as if you're running Let's say that you've got some kind of sandbox utility and you run your browser sandbox. Does that kind of mitigate it? Or
yes, that mitigates a lot of it when you're running it sandbox.
Because that should be just a standard. That should be a standard thing that happens.
Although if you allow the sandbox to write to your hard drive, then they can start encrypting files on your hard drive.
Yes, and that's,
so you have to watch what you allow through.
Right, and that's where the problems start coming in right away is because it is so crazy. These people who get the phone calls from Microsoft and things like that's not really Microsoft.
Oh yeah,
right.
It's the comes down to the end user because I have seen websites that have instructions of how to disable the antivirus before you download the product that they're talking about. And it's funny, and the reason they are like, oh, you want this free music application? First thing you do is turn off your antivirus. Here's instructions how to turn off all your different antiviruses, because this music program will be cited as a virus, but it's not. I mean, there's like literal instructions that people go through and follow because they really want whatever's at the other end of the rainbow. You know, we're promising free movies. Want to watch Star Wars for free? Just download this tool and load it on your computer. It clearly is not going to let you start for free, but you get people excited about it. So the social engineering aspect is what drives some of it. It's easy to secure computers. It's really hard to secure people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So that's what I had for the news this week.
Wow. Pretty interesting. Yeah, I remember seeing that ransomware thing. I thought, wow, you know, finally cross-platform.
Yeah, cross-platform ransomware. That's what we need in the world.
Right. Well, and even at that, they're not doing it very well because not only is it hard to get onto the computers, but then now you're able to, that it's not encrypted, right? So it's easy to decrypt it.
Yes. The researchers are still able to decrypt it.
Yeah, I wasn't able to read through the article about how they're doing it or what's wrong, but definitely. They're swinging and missing which is a good thing for us.
Good thing for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Me and my friend Phil, we had a discussion that maybe he works cybersecurity to some extent, securing data servers for his clients. And we're like, you ever thought you're on the wrong side of this when you see how much some of these guys are making? And I'm like, yeah. Removing the viruses is not near as profitable as it. It's like our morals keep us on the right side, but boy.
Morals and fear of jail.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, because
they so rarely catch any of these guys that steal credit cards and all that. They rarely make arrests. That's the one thing about it. And when they're doing it from third-party countries, there was an article I read a long time ago.
Well, if Donald Trump wins the presidency, though, he's going to turn the internet off from various countries.
And,
that'll help. All right.
That would solve the problem.
I'm trying to be funny there. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there's a good article read, and it was one of the former Soviet states. I can't remember which one it was. Maybe Croatia. They actually welcome a lot of the.
Croatia was not a former Soviet state.
No,
it was part of Yugoslavia.
Part of Yugoslavia. One of those areas over there.
Lithuania.
Latvia. Okay. Maybe that's it. What they had done was it was an article of how the
I'm
government.
I'm half Croatian. That's how I know that.
I know very little about that area. It was all just Russia and Europe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
they had some dividing lines and some arguments. There's my history lesson in Europe.
Right.
Anyways, there was some articles about different areas over there have no problem with the hackers being there. And the reason why is they bring influxes of money. And it's a ha-ha joke. They steal from the U.S. They steal credit cards. They steal whatever. And they kind of live like, you know,
it's an economic boom for them.
Because when was the last time you bought something from any of those places besides vodka?
Yeah.
So it brings money into their economy. So they have no interest. They're going, hold on, these guys are stealing from Americans and spending money here. Why exactly should we do something about it?
Yeah, you know, when you think about it, because ultimately you and I, if we're a victim of that, we don't pay that, the bank
We're inconvenienced, the bank pays.
I mean,
the
we pay it
stolen.
Indirectly
yes.
with higher fees and, you know, eventually.
Right.
Interest
I think,
rates
although I think
things.
Tom's point was, is if they had another source of income, like if they had something they're making over there that we want to buy, then they would be more incented to stop.
Yeah,
the hackers. But because the only thing that's interest of us
is vodka.
That they make is vodka, then they're like, yeah, they're still going to buy vodka, so why should we stop the hackers?
Yeah, if it brings money into the local economy, they're like, and of course, there's the joke, haha, you steal from rich Americans. It just makes it that much more fun for them. Yeah. There's this, there's an attitude. It's a couple years ago I read that article, but it made it interesting to me going, because you kind of wonder, how do they never catch these guys? There's just no interest over there. They're like, why? We don't have computers. What are we? They're not stealing from us. We don't understand exactly what they're doing. We just know they get money from Americans. Americans see us upset about it. But look, they brought money to the economy.
So,
interesting.
Interesting world we live in.
Yeah. So I have a few articles that I found. And interestingly, they're all on linked off of the sans.org site.
Interesting.
So that's it just makes it easy for me making links out. But anyway, so Comcast Home Security has a vulnerability.
Whoops.
That it says it's turned on, and it actually isn't. So I didn't have a chance to read through the article, but definitely follow the link, especially if you have
maybe that's how they're able to offer that internet so fast.
Right. it says the flaws could be manipulated to make the system report that the doors and windows are secured when they're not. So you want to be careful that, with that.
Oh, okay. I see. I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought it was just their... I see. It's a Comcast home security system.
Yeah.
Not the... I was just... Never mind.
Okay. No problem. Maybe I didn't say it right.
No, I think you did say it right. I just misinterpreted it. I forgot about that home security feature they've got.
Yeah. Sure. So the next link I have is Let's Encrypt won't revoke certificates used by malware.
Oh.
And... we've talked about it and just about everybody in the podcast world has talked about Let's Encrypt now and how easy it is to use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously it's easy for malware, producers to use it also. And, it creates the, an SSL tunnel to now send their malware across. And Let's Encrypt's point is that we're a CA, not a, not a filtering company.
No, and I think they have a good point there. And the reality is malware being delivered through SSL doesn't make a difference. It's not the traversal of malware that's the problem. It's the endpoint and the origination point. You know, we need to shut down websites that have it. Whether they're SSL or not doesn't really make a difference. And it's not like it's hard to check because when you register with Let's Encrypt, it asks you for your credentials. So if someone's trusting it for more than that, sorry, that's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to, like we said, talk about how you sandbox and do things on this end to prevent it. So, yeah. And users who download it, they didn't go, oh, I wasn't going to trust this file, but it came over SSL, therefore I will. Yeah. So
exactly.
I agree with the Let's Encrypt. I don't see this as a big issue. Everything just needs to move to encrypted by default.
Right. And that's where, like you said, just because it's encrypted doesn't mean the content coming across is safe.
Right.
All it does is it's safe against a random person trying to sniff your traffic that's coming across the internet.
Yep.
If you think about it, does this cause a problem for, you know, companies or for other things? A lot of the companies out there that, like, big corporations that are doing proxy filtering and you know, going through the company, they actually have a man-in-the-middle proxy that will actually breaks all your SSL connections, and goes through and inspects that data, what's coming across, and then decides to allow or not allow.
Yeah, they're already adding that extra trusted certificate on the computer so they can do the man-in-the-middle.
Right.
They're inspecting everything. They don't care if it came with SSL or not. It's getting inspected. So
And nowadays it's a very common practice for them to, at an enterprise level to do that.
Yes.
You know, my work does it. I'm sure all Ford, you know, all large companies are doing that.
Yeah.
So don't think you're going to go to work and surf Facebook because it's SSL and you're going to be safe. They're watching what you're doing.
Yes. And not only that, so much of the ads technically have already been delivered through SSL because we found a few of those, viruses, that what that happened was they were delivering.
Same difference.
One infects your head and one
infects your pocketbook.
Yeah. What they're doing is they were using they found a couple of them that were, even with Yahoo, they were going through the content delivery network, which is all delivered through SSL. aggregation through the content delivery networks, and they found out that that's how they were delivering the virus, through Flash. So we already had paid for by the CDNs. So not only was it, it was already through a paid for ad, to think about the traceability of that. So I don't, like I said, it's definitely an interesting point, but I'm completely on the side with Let's Encrypt. They can't get into that. That would destroy them as a business model to even say, hey, let's start trying to filter who does or doesn't.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and it's because their business model isn't vetting the company or the person.
Right.
It's just giving you the encrypted connection.
That's exactly.
That's all it does. Where if you want, you know, they have different levels of certificates, and what is it, EV, East, and now I can't remember what all the different levels are, but there's domain level, which would this, that's what the... Let's Encrypt does is domain level authentication or checking, and then there's organizational level, and that's where it's more expensive, but it gives you a better, you know, safer connection. Anyway, the next article I have is Time Warner customer data breached.
Ooh.
And it says Time Warner has acknowledged that the intruders have stolen email passwords as many as 320,000 of their customers. And if you're in the U.S., this is most likely going to affect you because, Time Warner is the second largest cable company, in the U.S. next to Comcast.
Well, what about Cox? Cox Communications?
They must be lower down the rung. Right. You know, in the area, Time Warner isn't very popular here.
No.
I mean, it is around here somewhere.
New York, but it's very, prevalent out there.
Well, Michigan's one of the few states that have that many. We have a lot of different cable providers here and a lot of competition. We're one of the, we actually pay a little bit less for internet here because of that. That's actually when you go to Comcast's website, why the first question is, what's your zip code? They do predatory pricing. Your pricing's higher in areas that they have exclusivity in and lower where they have competition. So Texas in a zip code where they have monopolies, you pay a lot more for Comcast.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, so they go on to say that how they didn't even know about the attack until the FBI came to them and said, hey, you might want to look at this.
Wake up. Wake up.
Yeah. That's when when you, if the FBI comes and says, well, you have a security breach, that's when you just go to your security guy, let him know it's his last day.
That's for sure.
Right. So if you have Time Warner, change your password there, and you might want to change your password everywhere else, because if you use your Time Warner email as the backup connection or the changed password email, then can easily be hacked also, and then they can get into all your other accounts. So definitely do it now. Now.
Wow, Tony. That was a lot of security stuff today.
Well, there's a lot more, but that's where I'm going to stop for today.
All right.
Oh, quick note. LastPass has a new version out.
Hey.
Yeah. I haven't read all the details, but I think there's a dead man's trigger option in there.
Yeah, that's what I heard. They added in where you can say, is it where you set specific people can get into it at after you're no longer able to get to it?
If you don't log in for a set amount of time, it can default to it. It just gives all my passwords access to someone I delegate it to, which is important.
I don't think it gives it to them.
It
enables the dead man trigger where that other person can request access.
There's a method by which it can happen.
Right. So you can either give it to your spouse or to your lawyer or that trigger request.
Yeah.
And it's like a big, long token that they have to send in for a request.
Well, I've thought about that. There's so much data I produce and things like that, and all of us do, you know, both personal and business for me, that someone needs to be delegated all of that information at some point. But I can't just write it all down because it changes from time to time, and maintaining a separate list also creates a security risk of where's that list at. So,
right. Yeah, unfortunately for me, everything here in the house, my wife doesn't know how to do anything with it. So if it dies, if I'm gone, nobody's going to be able to do anything with it. They'll have to just wipe my the OSs. And although on the fortunate side, I'm the only one that uses it, so nobody's going to be looking for it.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's probably even a whole topic of after death.
Oh, yeah. You know, LinkedIn, actually, I had a chance to use their capability to disable somebody's account who had passed away. It was a friend of mine, and I was pretty sure his family, well, I don't know for sure, but I passed along. This was like 8 months. His LinkedIn account was still there and everything, and I sent them the obituary, and I sent them all that info and just said, this gentleman passed away. And so they...
So I use a
tool. Disabled it.
Yeah.
I use a tool you ever heard of ThinkUp. So it's an engagement measurement tool.
What is it called?
ThinkUp. Gina Trapanian came up with it, but it's a really cool tool that measures social engagement and things like that. They had a little incident with the fact that it does things like you haven't interacted with this person for so long and stuff like that. It's all kinds of measurement tools, and I do it because I look at social media, look at our reach, and look at how our company's doing. And it's a business analytics tool to measure your reach on different networks. But one of the things they had done, and it seemed harmless, and it says they use the word, hey, here's the deadbeats you haven't heard from in a little while.
Oh.
And you can see how that can go wrong based on a topic.
Yeah.
Someone actually emailed Gina and says, my grandma was on that list and she died and no one knows how to delete her Facebook account.
Oh. You know that, yeah. That might be a fresh looks.
Yeah. There's a lot to think about that there because before, you know, you distribute someone's value. Now here's where you get into really weird concepts. I own movies. That or different media things, apps, all kinds of stuff I bought that are intangibles. They're tied to my Google account. Now, I have my Google account set to delegation, but that's only getting further. You know, as my daughter buys music she likes and books she like, or I have an entire book library I've purchased that's all digital, but they're locked up, so to speak. Now, I own the content to them, but think about that from a media standpoint. People who go, yeah, I bought all the Star Wars. Well, normally when you have a living will and you distribute the person's goods after they're, you know, passed on to their kids, how do you pass on all that if they don't have the passwords, if they don't have it?
Yeah.
Can you transfer the rights to all these movies that are bought in movie libraries that are digital to the next person?
Probably not.
Right now, there's not a lot of method to do that.
Right.
They can log in as you, but then they have to be you after death to watch your movies that you paid for.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly. We can get way off topic.
We're getting creepy. all right. Well, let's see. I got a quick KDE corner, and then I think we'll wrap. We'll do a wrap. I just wanted to mention that in Phoronix, and anybody who reads that on a regular basis, that this was posted yesterday. It was quite a lengthy, actually about 9 pages worth, of KDE Plasma 5.5 review. Two things that caught my eye from this review was the fact that they have finally got the GTK Breeze-style application theme in there, because anybody uses KDE extensively, when you use a GTK app like GIMP, you notice that it doesn't follow that kind of smooth look that you have in KDE. Not that the look is smooth, but at least as far as just the style, it's all kind of standard. It looks the same.
Yeah, it doesn't follow your theme.
Yeah, so when you open up a GTK app, it uses the GTK of libraries default, and all of that. It looks different. But this,
and actually GTK by default looks pretty ugly too.
Yes.
So I agree with you.
Yeah. So what's really nice about the KDE Plasma 5.5, it's going to incorporate the GTK Breeze style and application theme, so that when those apps open now, they're going to look a little more. It'll smoothly transition. You won't really have that glaring GTK look.
All right.
That kind of bugs me. And the only other thing I want to mention about this too is that they talk about KDE Connect, and I got to tell you, at PenguCon last April, I gave a little lecture. A presentation on Dolphin, and part of that included KDE Connect. And
yeah, that looked really cool.
I have to tell you, I use it now. I was able to move music. I have music on my computer, and I just go into Dolphin but I believe that you're going to be able to use it outside of Dolphin.
Yeah.
You can just, as long as you install KDE Connect and probably the requisite libraries, but you can right click on any folder in there and basically send it to whatever devices are connected via KDE Connect. And
wow.
I had a Christmas party thing that I was getting ready for, and so I just simply identified my music and said, send it to my phone via KDE Connect, and boom, 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 all of them went over there. It was nice. It was very quick, and I didn't even have to plug my phone in.
That's nice.
It was very nice. Anyway, but
can't you also do like screen sharing or see your screen through KDE Connect? I thought there was something like that, or you can control programs on your phone.
Yeah, you can, I think. Yeah, there's some remote, you can turn into like a remote thing and you can do some things.
That's cool.
I might have to go back and look because I haven't looked at that aspect of it because I use it mainly for just moving files, to and from. But
okay.
Yeah, it's really sweet.
That's pretty cool.
So, yeah. But anyway, yeah, so it kind of goes into, it kind of waxes poetic and eloquent about KDE Connect and really how it's coming along and is really nice. So, but anyway, cool. Yeah, so that's Inphronix. I'll do my best to get that link in the show notes for KDE Plasma 5.5. It's called the Quintessential 2016 Review.
All right.
So that's KDE Corner.
Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
I think we're coming toward the end, right?
I think we are.
Music left and...
Yeah.
Yeah, so this week... I don't know if you listened to the last couple of shows, Tom had suggested to listen to somebody called Dramatic.
Grammatic.
Grammatic, you're right.
Sorry,
this week, this week we're going to do that. And Tom suggested the song Torture.
which might be...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, which might be your experience in just listening to us this morning.
Right.
So we're going to continue it.
Yeah, so
yes. Here we go. Song.
Yeah. The video is pretty funny. We got it's about a
old man.
The old man breaking out of a nursing home and
being chased on a scooter.
Yeah.
Yeah,
mobility
but
scooter.
But leading up to that, what's funny about it is that he gets this helmet, this leather jacket, and you think he's going to take off on this Harley.
Yeah.
Well, it's a scooter with a Harley sticker.
Yeah. Yes.
It's very funny.
Older person scooter, not a motorcycle scooter.
Yeah. So it has pretty good music licks, and I like
it's
it.
It's a toe tapper.
Yeah.
So thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
And Tony.
You're welcome. All right, so we've come to the end of the show. This has been episode 176.
Quickie.
That's right. this is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence.
See you next time.
All right. You know, I noticed that right in the middle of that.
We weren't recording?
No, we are recording.
All right.
No, but we had like 8 viewers at one point. Halfway
really?
Through, I looked up to see how many there was. There were 0.
Mm-hmm.
And then now we have 6.
Wow.
So,
well, thank you,
everybody.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Yeah, so we're coming
right
to the
everybody
end.
And having week back-to-back episodes.
Right.
Well, just due to travel.
Right. But all even right. though this is the end, you can just re-click on the link. And you can start from the beginning.
Yes.
Right now.
Why would
probably
you do
right
that?
Now because of the wonderful use of Google Hangouts and everything. It's a YouTube video now.
Automatic.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I'll share with you guys the, you want to hear the really funny HR story he told me?
Yeah.
So he had to do an onboarding of a guy, and the guy had to start work at 7 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is down south. He kind of had some redneck and it was a manufacturing job.
Okay.
So he had to start the training at 3 a.m. because they hired the guy and immediately needed this machine operator to get this done. So he had to start training the guy at 3 a.m. so he could start working this. So it was an odd scenario of things that occurred to cause this. But this is where it gets funny is he's talking to the guy and this guy says, you know, they're saying, yeah, this is tough and blah, blah, blah. And the guy, this kind of redneck guy goes, well, what a wicked web we weave. And the guy who does HR, he's a trained writer and, of course, has read Hamlet and things like this. So he finishes and starts saying a little bit of some of the Hamlet, you know, finishes the whole sentence. And the guy stares at him blankly and he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. And he goes, Hamlet, you know, this is the person that said this quote. And he's sharing and he goes, well, sir, we don't get that radio station down here.
Oh, my goodness. That was funny.
He says, you know, sometimes you got to think about the environment you're in. And go, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's good.
All right. Never heard of Hamlet.
We probably should kill our broadcast, I guess.
Bye.
We're wrapping up. Okay,
my
bye,
story
everyone.
Killed 2 of them off. 3, yeah, 2.
Right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Okay.
All right. And for our audio butt listeners, thanks for listening.
Yes. Thanks for listening on broadcast using this tool. Somebody has to clean that up.
That's right.
All right.
All right.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.
Hi, folks. This is Chatter. Jay Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Linux Luddites is a show where we try out all the latest free and open source software and then decide we like the old stuff better.
More than just news and releases, we check out a wide range of Linux distros, cover your feedback, talk about obscure command line programs, discuss burning issues over a pint, and much, much more. So join me, Paddy,
and me, Joe, every 2 weeks for news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy at linuxluddites.com.
Linux Luddites, because not all change is progress.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit lhspodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
The Linux Link Tech Show, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast. On the web, www.tllts.org. By email, techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC channel, thelinuxlink.net, port 6667/techshow. And Flying Rich is so hot.